Coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK,
The Lutheran Inquisitor, examining pressing issues and their ramifications for the Church today.
Hello and welcome to The Lutheran Inquisitor. I'm your host, John Ehlers, pastor of Christ Lutheran Church in Orpington, Kent. I'd like to thank you for listening to Lutheran Radio, and especially I'd like to thank you for your prayers and your financial support, for without both of those, we wouldn't be able to continue. I'd also like to encourage you to go to our website, lutheran.co.uk, find the nearest Lutheran congregation to where you live by clicking on the directory button, and encourage you to go and pay them a visit. Today on LRUK, we are having a chat with Dr. Robert Rosine. Dr. Rosine is professor of historical theology at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, Missouri. He is currently here in Cambridge. Teaching some courses at Westfield House, the Theological College of the ELCE. And Bob is an old friend of the ELCE and LRUK, and we've invited him back to talk about Philip Melanchthon. Bob, who is Philip Melanchthon? Some of our listeners may not have any idea who he is. When was he born? What did he do? Can you give us a bit of biographical detail about him?
Sure, be happy to. It's nice to be back. Thanks for the invitation. The Reformation, I suppose, is most associated with the name Martin Luther, not just because this is Lutheran radio, but even the Reformed branch of the Reformation recognized that Luther got a head start on them. John Calvin was a generation younger than Luther, born in 1509, Luther in 1483. Ulrich Zwingli had a life coterminous with Luther, born nearly the same time. He was killed in battle fighting for Zurich in 1531. If Calvin is sort of the second man, Zwingli is often thought of as the third man, Luther being the first. There are others, however, maybe the fourth, though he might rank higher than fourth, is one Philip Melanchthon. Philip Melanchthon is a co-worker of Luther's, came from a very different background than did Luther, very different schooling early on, a different path into Reformation, but he found his way also into evangelical theology. Together with Luther, they formed a really good team, I think. There are others, of course, on the Wittenberg faculty. Together, it was a good group, a good mix. Melanchthon served a very useful purpose in helping with the dissemination and the formulation of Lutheran doctrine, working well with Luther. He certainly came from a different background, as I mentioned. He was born on the 16th of February in 1497, Luther in 1483, so he's about roughly 14, 15 years younger than Luther, about half a generation. He died in April of 1560, so he outlived Luther also by about 14 years. Luther died in 1546. Melanchthon came from a different part of the country than did Luther, a different part of the empire. Luther was born in Thuringia, over in Saxony to the east, in the north. Melanchthon came from the west and from the south, from a town called Breton, B-R-E-T-T-E-N. Breton is in what is today the modern area of Baden, way over, not so far from Karlsruhe, if maybe the listeners have a modern map and can find that easily enough. Breton was destroyed during the wars with the French in the 17th century. So today, if you go back to Breton, they will show you the Melanchthon House. Yeah, that's a reconstruction. That's not the original one that was there. But that was his town. His father was the armorer, an armor maker for one of the dukes of the Palatinate, a responsible position. You have to trust your armorer to do a good job. You know, if he messes up on the alloys, you might just buy the ranch, so to speak, or whatever they said in the 16th century. It was a responsible position. It was a comfortable enough home. His mother schooled him a little bit at home, and then Melanchthon was sent away to a town called Pforzheim. Today, if you take the Autobahn between Stuttgart and Karlsruhe, Pforzheim is just about halfway along the way in the area of Swabia. There was a school there known for its humanist educational curriculum. We should talk about humanism a little later here. Melanchthon was encouraged to go there. It was kind of a progressive advanced school, something different from the run-of-the-mill curricula that you find certainly in village schools, for sure. He lived in Pforzheim with his mother's mother. She, his grandmother, was the sister of Johannes Reuchlin. Reuchlin was a famous Hebraist. Hebrew studies were on the rise because of Renaissance humanism again. They come in a poor third. People are more interested in classical Latin than Greek, then Hebrew kind of third place. There just isn't as much literature there. There was a certain bent against learning Hebrew. We'll come to that in just a second again. But Reuchlin thought it was worth it because that way you can study the Old Testament scriptures. So Reuchlin set about to put together a grammar on Hebrew, Hebrew word books, dictionaries. Luther picked up these tools. Luther, remember, is just about a half a generation older, so he's already well into his schooling. He picked up Reuchlin's books and really taught himself Hebrew. This is always a very discouraging thing for seminary students to hear. You know, when they're slogging away through Hebrew class and you say, well, Luther was self-taught. You know, they just don't want to hear that. Go away, you know. We wish it were that simple. He worked hard at it, and Reuchlin was very important for Hebrew studies and Old Testament for Reformation. There was a controversy that arose later on in the early 15-teens with Reuchlin. There was a converted Jew, converted to Christianity, a man named Pfefferkorn. Pfefferkorn, being an ex-non-believer, now believer, is like a lot of ex-things. Ex-smokers are sometimes militant against others who smoke. You know, you give up something and now it becomes your crusade to make everyone see the light, to see the truth. Well, Pfefferkorn was of a mind that now that he saw the truth of Christianity, other Jews should be brought into the fold as well. And so he advocated destroying the writings of the Jews and forbidding Hebrew studies. This would be a way to force people into looking at the Bible, especially the New Testament, and away from these old ideas that he thought were still leading people astray for not accepting the Christ. There is a controversy then that breaks out. Pfefferkorn on the one side gets support from the Dominicans, who would like to control the educational curriculum. And on the other side was Reuchlin with his fellow humanists, his fellow liberal arts supporters, who said, what's the harm in this? You learn the language so you can read the texts. Wouldn't we be better informed? Couldn't we explain the Old Testament better if we could do it in Hebrew rather than simply through Latin translations? Certainly through scholastic logic, through syllogistic logic. The paper war goes back and forth. There is finally the humanists on one side, the defenders of the Hebrew studies, write a series of essays called Letters of Famous Men. And before the other side can reply, the humanist side wrote a response for them called the Letters of Obscure Men, which is full of terrible bombastic Latin, bad grammar, poorly written. You just have to laugh when you read it. It was made to look it was done to make the other side look foolish, and they certainly did. The Dominicans were outraged at being mocked this way. What's interesting with our Melanchthon connection is that Melanchthon wrote a preface to one of the editions of the Letters of Obscure Men, although this was done quietly so that he didn't get the publicity for it. He didn't want the publicity for it at the time. But his great-uncle was the center of this controversy. Reuchlin is the one who persuaded Melanchthon actually to call himself Melanchthon. The family name was Schwarzerd, S-C-H-W-A-R-T-Z, E-R-D or E-R-D-T. German in those ways was spelled a little bit loosely. Students today would love to be able to spell the German way. Just come close so it pronounces correctly. It's phonetic. Schwarzerd means black dirt, black soil, black ground. That was the family name. What happened often when you got an education, especially a liberal arts education in the humanist vein, was that you sort of showed off your learning by Latinizing your name or putting in some kind of a Greek form. And that's what Melanchthon is. It's the Greek for Schwarzerd. Others involved in the Reformation were people like Johannes Bugenhagen came from an area called Pomerania up north along the seacoast. They called him Pomeranus. Another reformer whose family name was Bauer, means farmer, adopted the Latinized name Agricola. That became his last name. This kind of stuff went on, a way of kind of showing off a little bit. And Luther himself even did this for 3 years. From about 1517 to 1520 or so, he started to call himself Eleutherius, which was a play on the Greek, meaning the liberated one, as if he'd found the gospel now and was freed from the things that used to oppress him. Well, Reuchlin persuaded Melanchthon to Greekicize his name, if we can make up a word like that, and encouraged him in liberal arts, in humanist studies. He was a precocious kid. Before he was even 13 years old, he went away to the University of Heidelberg. Now, people went earlier in those days. They didn't wait till 18, 19 or so for the university. 13 is still young. At 13, Luther is still in one of the normal Latin schools before heading to university. But Melanchthon went off to Heidelberg. Within 2 years, he got his bachelor's degree in 1511. The next year, he applied to get a master's degree. You did this by having studied, having read. And the thing was, you had to then pass a disputation, a kind of a debate using scholastic logic, syllogistic logic. The professor would argue one side of a set of theses. You would defend and argue the other. They did this for the BA, for the MA, and finally for doctoral degrees. Well, Melanchthon wanted to do his MA promotion, get his degree. Heidelberg, the university where he was at, thought he was too young. They were afraid people would look at them as being kind of a, well, I don't think you could say diploma mill, because this was a rare case. But they'd say, how in the world can you give an MA to some kid who's, you know, about 15, 16 years old? They declined. Melanchthon became impatient, and he transferred. He went upstream on the Neckar. There are two universities on the Neckar River. Heidelberg is at the Neckar, not too far from the Rhine. Farther upstream down in Swabia is Tübingen, very picturesque place there with the boats that punt back and forth, kind of like the boats on the Cam. There's a little dam downstream. Nobody sees that. That's why the water is nice and broad and slow at that point. It's a really nice town, an old university town. The university was founded in 1477, so Heidelberg was not quite 100 years older. Traditions were a little more set. They had a bit more of a reputation to defend. Tübingen was a little more open, shall we say. They were willing to take Melanchthon in. And they said that they thought he could get his MA. He actually waited then a little bit and didn't get it for several years. In the meantime, though, he studied and lectured, sort of adjunct lectures on some of the Latin writers, not part of the regular curriculum, but that he even had that kind of a status at his young age is quite amazing. He wrote a Greek grammar in 1518. And it was the Greek grammar that caught the attention of others, such as Frederick the Wise, who was looking for a Greek professor by then. The great uncle Reuchlin recommended Melanchthon. Frederick looked at Melanchthon and said, here's a young guy. If you can put it in modern parlance, Frederick's thinking, we can get him cheap, and he's young, he'll be here a long time if he comes. That's the kind of person you want to invest in as far as potential faculty. It's not the person Luther actually had in mind. Luther had his eye on someone else. The guy Luther was interested in actually turned out not to be a supporter of the Reformation in the long run. So who knows how that would have turned out if they'd had a different faculty mix. But for Melanchthon, this was a step up to Wittenberg and to this new university that was there.
Now, you've mentioned humanism a couple of times. Can you explain to us how Melanchthon and his time at Wittenberg was involved in the education, in the humanist form of education, and what that involves?
Humanism, of course, in the 16th century is not like modern humanism. Today, it's the 21st century now. 20th century, secular humanism, the kind from Bertrand Russell, who was at Cambridge, secular humanism at first marginalizes God, infers that he's perhaps not there, and then that was the Humanist Manifesto from the 1930s. And then a revised Humanist Manifesto about a generation later simply says God does not exist. Man is the center of all things. I think when people today hear humanism, often they think of a kind of indulgent, self-serving, hedonistic, anthropocentric worldview. I guess that's pretty bad, just the way that lays out. That's not what it's like in the 16th century. The 16th century actually didn't use the word humanism. That's a 19th century term applied. They talked about the studia humanitatis, the study of man, study of mankind. It is true that man is the focal point of the study, but this is not apart from the larger context of God and the created order. I think the best way to kind of understand this is to think of a book title from a professor, late professor at University of Michigan, a man named Charles Trinkaus. Trinkaus has a two-volume set called In Our Image and Likeness. It's a play on the first chapter of Genesis, where God says, let us make man in our own image and likeness. The idea was mankind, humanity, is in the image of God. Just what is that image? See, what does this all entail? If man is the foremost creature of God, done in special creation on the sixth day, as Genesis recounts, then we ought to pay attention. Man is not just another animal, not just another part of the created order, but something distinct and special. So what might that all involve? The idea was that there are talents, abilities there to be used. He's put, in the Genesis account, in charge to have dominion, see, to lordship over it. So the world is not his. It's a grand stewardship placed into his hands. But you don't give that to just anybody. You give that to someone who has talents and abilities. These things need to be developed. In classical antiquity, there was a kind of balance in the liberal arts. There was the trivium and the quadrivium. Trivium, three subjects: grammar, logic, and rhetoric. Grammar is just that, parts of speech, how one puts together a coherent communication package. So you can say things like, door, room, slams, person. Doesn't mean much. But if grammatically you put this in order, you could say the person slams the door for going into the room. And now suddenly you have a kind of meaning, a sentence there. Grammar communicates something. Combine grammar into a certain form, a certain flow, with certain rules of thinking, and you have a logic. Aristotle has a logic. Aristotle's syllogisms, if A, if B, therefore C, was one way of organizing grammatical sentences. Then if you add those up in a larger whole, you get a kind of rhetorical argument or a rhetorical effort also to persuade, because not everything can be done simply by logic. Some things you have to persuade people on. Logic, you can say, is five bigger than four. Well, you know, that's pretty simple. You can put out four of this and five of that and say this is a bigger pool. The five is larger. That's simple. You can say, which is the better university, Cambridge or Oxford? Say, and now you've got an argument going, because you've got better or worse. You've got reasons one side or the other. You probably can't make a simple logical argument, but you can try to persuade people based on kind of the weight of certain evidence to bring them over. Grammar, logic, rhetoric were communication tools, how you would think and analyze and then communicate meaning. Meaning of what? The next four subjects were the quadrivium. Four subjects were mathematics or arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, and music. Math is a language, again. We know this is easy to talk about today with computers. Binary computers, things are one or zero. The electron zips this way or that way. Do that often enough and combine all your ones and zeros in a kind of code, and you can communicate in a language. Mathematics is a way of analyzing, communicating. Put it into spatial relations, looking at the world around us, and math becomes geometry, describing the world around, the physical world. Astronomy is kind of a collected word, kind of a code word for all the natural sciences as they understood them in those days. what is science like in the world around. And music, again, same thing, but for fine arts. There are relationships between these different fields. Planets have certain mathematical intervals they came to discover. Or we talk about the music of the spheres. Music itself has mathematical relationships. Take a string, make it half the size, half the length, pluck it, and you're an octave higher than you are with the original string that you pluck. So these things all kind of seem to come together, fold together in a kind of coherent package, which is studied and then communicated through the trivium. That's what was supposed to happen. What happens, in fact, is during the Middle Ages, a lot of the learning kind of falls on hard times. It was a difficult era. Not as much attention, effort was always paid to a broader liberal arts education. Education was geared especially for careers within the church, narrower focuses. Church law or theology would dominate, maybe not things like the natural sciences. When the Crusades brought the East in contact with the West, part of the new things that came West was a kind of revitalizing of Aristotle. I mentioned Aristotle and his logic. He also had been kind of lost to time, but was recovered and saw a kind of resurgence, a kind of new life in the 12th century. The church and the universities very quickly realized that Aristotelian logic was very useful for organizing thought. Aristotle not only has the if A, if B, therefore C syllogisms with all the other variations, the rebuttals, the qualifiers, and so forth, but he also, Aristotle was interested in science, and he tended to think things through in kind of clear categories. He will talk about an efficient, formal, material, and final cause, causes for things. Efficient is what makes a thing happen. Material is what is the thing that's happening. The formal is what shape does it take. And the final is to what end do these things happen? Why do these things happen? And his argument was that everything ought to have these four causes. You ought to be able to organize. Well, you think through the world around you this way, and you tend to think in very kind of logical, patterned fashion. The rhetoric side of things tends to fade away. Logic comes to dominate. And after the 12th century, logic was the be-all and the end-all for education. You spent time on syllogisms. You argued and debated with disputation. Who has the better logical argument, one over against the other? And the broader liberal arts is eclipsed, really. They're really kind of put into the shadow. Long about the middle of the 14th century, however, though, there is a kind of revival of the liberal arts. There is a movement called the Renaissance, a rebirth of classical culture. There is a monk, Petrarch, an Augustinian monk, who uncovers Cicero's letters and writings, sees it's a different style of Latin. And this is the opening of the door to a lot of recovery of old thought that had been just put on the shelf, sometimes literally on the shelf, and forgotten about. The Renaissance humanists, the rebirth of the study of man, of the liberal arts, never said that we don't need logic. They simply argued that life is much richer and broader than this. And they argued that understanding the scripture should not be reduced to simply logical exercises either. See, if you do that, you can get some very bad theology. Let's take an Aristotle syllogism. If God is wise and good and makes no mistakes, and if God gives you the law and says, keep it and you'll win and live, don't keep it and you'll die, therefore, and you can see where this is going to lead, therefore, there must be some way, shape, or form in which you can keep the law. Now, you can say, oh, I can't do that by myself. No, probably not. That would be called Pelagianism. That was an old heresy. The church had rejected that. But what about if God enabled you by grace to now finish off, to do what he's asked you to do? See, God wouldn't ask you if you couldn't do it. God can say, all right, from where you are right now, seated in a chair, leap up and slap your hands on the ceiling. And you say, I can't possibly do that. Well, are you calling God a fool? Clearly, if God made this a law and said, do this, there must be some way you can do it. If he says, don't kill, don't steal, don't commit adultery, don't do these various things, be perfect, There must be some way in which you can accomplish those, probably enabled by his grace. That means you work at it. That means your salvation is a combination of faith plus works. It also means, as Luther discovered, that you never come to the end. How much is enough? Where do I finally find a loving God who's going to accept me and take me as I am? No, I have to keep trying harder. See, when is the end? It drove Luther to distraction. It drove him into the monastery, really. There was the old saying, desperation makes monks. That was really true. See, the logical syllogisms demanded an answer. Luther discovered, through the use of Renaissance humanist language studies, word studies, that when Paul talks about righteousness, that he is talking about a quality that God gives rather than a quantity of good that God expects me to come up with. That's the product of Renaissance humanist learning. Now, humanism went into all sorts of avenues and down different streets. Melanchthon came along at a time when humanism was around in other schools like the one in Pforzheim. And his parents decided that that was progressive modern education for their day. They wanted him to go there. It influenced him. He went away to Heidelberg, where the old scholastic logic dominated in the university. The faculties at the universities were these people were scholastic thinkers. And they had no interest in opening up the curriculum to other alternatives. I mean, why should they? They control the faculty, you know. It's reasonable. It's logical. You know, you wouldn't want to sort of surrender and open up to alternatives. So he goes, but he uncovers and encounters scholasticism in the classroom, which he hated. He called it deadly, dull, and boring. There was one case of a professor who tried on the blackboard to diagram how transubstantiation occurred. Melanchthon thought this was just the most ridiculous thing he'd ever seen in his life, this kind of logical argument. Outside, however, in the community around universities, there would always be these humanists hovering around. They are offering courses on the side. They were trying to get into the regular curriculum, trying to be part of the regular community, but at best they were kind of always sort of adjunct, kind of extracurricular. It's a little like going to the university today and you see these kiosks around campuses where they'll say things like, learn Korean Tuesday and Thursday nights, and then a phone number. So, you know, you tear off the little slip, call up, and suddenly you're part of a little informal Korean course given by somebody, some Korean graduate student who's making a little extra pocket money on the side for teaching classes. You learn Korean. Great. Wonderful. You know, what good does that do you for your program, however? Now, I'm better educated, but it's not really something that pays off in terms of my formal degree. Well, Melanchthon got his formal degree, his BA and his MA then at Tübingen, but along the way, he's always interested in these other subjects, and he wrote a Greek grammar. That's a humanist, a tool that the humanists could use to better study classical Greek and also eventually also read the New Testament. This new learning is exciting for him. It opens up new doors, new possibilities. That's why, again, Melanchthon, the Greekicized name that he's got, that's a humanist affectation. That's what humanists did to sort of show that we're part of this party, part of this new progressive learning. Wittenberg has a special place in the history of education in terms of universities. All these other universities have scholastic logic as the standard approach to learning, if A, if B, therefore C, in whatever the subjects are. They would draw up a series of theses, dispute them back and forth. That's how learning was developed, built. That's how rough edges were knocked off and truth was discovered, they thought. Wittenberg was a little different, however. Wittenberg University, in its charter, actually made room for Renaissance humanism. This was something that was unheard of at the time, not found at other universities, but it made Wittenberg different, and it made it really the platform for the Reformation. That's something I think worth talking about a little more.
Dr. Rosin, unfortunately, we've run out of time, and according to logic, that's where we've got to stop. But we invite you back next week, as well as our listeners, as we continue this discussion of the humanist mode that took place, as we continue our discussion of how humanism shaped the lives of Melanchthon and Luther at the University of Wittenberg. And again, we thank you, and we look forward to hearing from you next week.
Thank you for listening to The Lutheran Inquisitor with Pastor John Ehlers. If you have any questions or comments about the issues raised in this program, send an email to info@lutheranradio.co.uk. The podcast of this show is available from our website. Check our program online and stay tuned.